I'm Kit. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April Fool's Day of 1994. And I have a sponsor, Chris, and he has a sponsor, Johnny, and he has a sponsor, Clancy. And I have no idea who Clancy's sponsor is. And my home group is the Midtown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you, Sam, for inviting me out here to speak tonight. If you don't like my story, that's the guy you blame. And if you like my story, you thank the guy up top, because my story is just what I got. I grew up on the rough streets of McLean, Virginia. I did not find out until actually fairly recently that I come from a long line of alcoholics and outright mental defectives on my father's side of the family. It turned out that he was basically the only normal person in the family with no issues at all. And on my mom's side of the family, my mom was the alcoholic and everybody else was normal with no issues at all. So I get it sort of oddly from both sides. But I grew up in McLean. It was at that time a nice middle class government town, right inside the Beltway. And when I was growing up, the drinking age was 18. And all through high school, there was always, someone had an older brother or sister who could get alcohol. And, as long as you weren't driving into trees or raising a ruckus, the police didn't bother you. And looking back on it and having been to a few high school reunions, I drank normally in high school. I could have a beer and be fine, or not have a beer at a party and be fine. It was no big deal. Never got rip-roaring drunk in high school. Never got a few, buzzed a few times. It was okay, not a big deal. And at the high school reunions, a lot of people I knew were surprised to find out I'd ended up in AA. I graduated high school in 83, and that was in 82 when I was in high school. My mom died, basically of alcoholism. She came down with breast cancer. It spread to her liver, and she continued to drink a bottle or two of wine a night while on chemo. And the idea of chemo back then was it killed the cancer a little quicker than it was killing the patient, and her liver basically could not cope. And so the last 2 weeks of her life, she was detoxing while dying of cancer. And it was pretty awful. And so I never drank wine because that was what she drank, because I was not going to be like her. And I went to college at George Mason University, a fine university. And, some people get into fraternities, but I found the crew team. And apparently these days, crew is, extremely healthy. They eat right, they get lots of exercise, they go to bed early, they get up early, they live a healthy life. When I was there, we were the drinkingest sport in the NCAA. We were a club, not an official school team. And also, I was not in the quiet dorms. As I said, the drinking age was 18, so they allowed alcohol in the dorms. It was co-ed dorms. This was before AIDS was really an issue. And spent 2 years at Mason. And at the end of that 2 years, I had a cumulative grade point average of 0.0. And I got a nice little letter from the dean inviting me to leave and never come back. I was academically expelled. And, I've been back twice, both times to leave meetings. That's the only times I've been back because I got that letter and I don't go back. A lot of craziness when I was there at school. The alcohol was still basically, it wasn't destroying my life yet, at least not obviously outside of all of that. And there were a few of the incidents where I would wake up and my first thoughts were, where am I? Where are my clothes? Who am I in bed with? I hope to God they're of the appropriate sex. And these days, if someone who is, in their 30s showed up that looked like me, I would not be extraordinarily surprised. I was not a massive blackout drinker because at some point in time I discovered when I was at Mason that if I did cocaine, I would not black out and I would not pass out. And I could drink pretty much as I wanted. And years later, I would come to realize that if I'm using drugs to control the consequences of my drinking, that's probably a sign I'm an alcoholic. You know, at the time, it was just like, wow, massive, amazing discovery, you know? Other people are doing coke because it makes them feel good, and they're happy, and they're awake, and I'm doing it because then I can drink more. I was smoking a lot of weed back then, too. The thing about weed was it was predictable. I would smoke a bowl, do some lung-busting bong hits, and I would sit in the basement where we'd started, or I'd be out sitting in the woods where we'd started, and that's where we would stay. Nothing really weird would happen. We would just sort of hang out there. If I started drinking, you know, it would just, you know, be running around town and heading off into Georgetown and just, you know, I'm not sure how I never got arrested, but somehow I avoided that. But in the spring of 85, when I realized that I was going to be getting that letter from the dean, I went out down and talked to an Army recruiter, because that's what you do when you've, you know, blown your life up and I decided I need to get my act together, and joining the Army was, I guess, the traditional way of doing that, at least so I thought at the time. Figured the Army would straighten me up and I'd learn how to, you know, be a man or whatever. And a lot of the benefits from the Army kicked in years later after I got sober. At the time, the Army was where I did my heaviest drinking. But in 1985, you know, having flunked out of college on my dad's nickel, I went off to basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And 6 weeks into basic, somehow I always fell in with a crowd of people that were low-life dirtbags like me, basically. And we were not infantry. We were, you know, all sorts of support people. And so we weren't expected to do really well in the range, but still the drill sergeants wanted us to do a little better. So when we went out to shoot our 40 targets to qualify, we all had 50 rounds, because the drill sergeants gathered us all around and handed us an extra 50 rounds, and we all shot expert. You know, go figure. And, yeah, thank you, Drill Sergeant Butler and Drill Sergeant Reed. They got us, and, you know, we did so well, they gave us a special one-night pass to go to the local enlisted club near the barracks and do what we wanted. And that was, so after 6 weeks of not drinking, I went out and had, I'm not sure how much I had, to be honest. I know the next day was, we had a formation after, and there were several of us that were being held up by the soldiers on either side of us. But we were all there. And the next day I was introduced to the Army's Miracle Hangover Cure, which is you get up in the morning and you run 5 miles with the drill sergeant yelling at you. Sweats the hangover right out of you. And you have a couple glasses of water, you take a shower, you're good to go for the day. It helped to be 20. And most of the people, I think, that were in basic with me that were in that shape, they did not drink like that again if they were doing PT the next day. For me, it really was the miracle hangover cure. It was awesome. It was like cocaine, except we couldn't do coke. Well, I thought we couldn't do coke in the Army. And after graduating basic, I went off to advanced training at Fort Gordon and, you know, various adventures there. Nothing that I got in trouble for, mainly because the MPs didn't catch us. We had one barroom brawl where we just sort of destroyed the enlisted club there. We tangled some guys from the 82nd, and we knew the second floor balcony exit, and they didn't, so they all got caught by the MPs, and we all limped on back to barracks and didn't dare go on sick call despite being various kinds of injured. And, you know, looking back, it's still one of those funny stories. Mm-hmm. But, and then the Army sent me to Korea, which was, couldn't get weed in Korea unless you smuggled it in yourself. All the other drugs, well, coke was coming in for a while, but not really much of that, or so I thought, at least at the beginning, for the drugs. And so I did a lot of heavy drinking in Korea. There's this drink called soju, which is like Korean gin, has little, the one stuff we drank had a little layer of formaldehyde at the top to, I guess, give it a little extra kick, and you'd shake it up, and so the formaldehyde would mix throughout. And because American booze was rationed, 4 units a month, you know, a case or a fifth was a unit. And so you'd save it up for, like, parties and stuff. Otherwise, you're drinking the Korean rock gut down in town. And, again, the Army Miracle Hangover Cure. And that one's you're running behind some guy who had kimchi with his dinner the night before. So, and the first sergeant's opinion was that as long as you caught up with the outfit before they got back, you were good. You know, if you had to pull over and barf, that was fine. Just catch up with us. And on New Year's Eve of 1985, I went out drinking with friends. All my, you know, stupid things start out drinking with friends. And this one guy who'd been there a couple months longer than I had pulled out this handful of pills. He said, "Want some of these?" And I said, "Sure." Didn't ask what they were. Didn't ask what they did. He took a handful of them, so I took a handful of them. I didn't stop to think that maybe he had a tolerance and I didn't. And then things got kind of fuzzy. And the next thing I remember is waking up on New Year's Day of 1986 in the 121st Evac Hospital in Seoul, Korea, strapped down with tubes in my arms, and they pumped my stomach. And if you're strapped down, it means you've really been an ass. I don't remember anything that happened. I took the pills, and about half an hour later, everything just kind of fades. But, you know, I'd had a drug overdose is what happened. I OD'd in downers and booze is what it was. So that morning, they saw that I was awake and coherent, and they pulled the tubes out of me, and they unstrapped me, and they sent me on my way back to my outfit with a little bus ticket, and I'm covered, of course, with charcoal, and just looking like a real good advertisement for the U.S. Army on New Year's Day. And I got to talk to Sergeant Major at the brigade headquarters, because I was in a brigade headquarters. And Sergeant Major Denny had done 4 tours in Vietnam. He jumped into Grenada. He had a different combat patch for every day of the week. And I wish I had a recording of the ass chewing, because he didn't raise his voice and he didn't cuss, and I never did downers again. Mm-hmm. And from that day to this, when I'm given pills and a prescription, I take them exactly as prescribed. And when they're done, I'm done. When I had my wisdom teeth out in the Army, they gave me oxys of some kind, and I took them exactly as prescribed, and when they were done, I was done. If he'd given me that ass chewing about my drinking, I'd probably be psychotic by now, because I'd be, several decades dry. But then he disappeared the paperwork. It was essentially God was talking to me. He was very disappointed, and he made it clear that everyone was allowed one screw up, and that was mine. And I didn't get caught the whole rest of the time I was in Korea. I did other stupid things. I smuggled weed into Korea, which that's a couple centuries down out there. And an ounce of weed, some hash, triple bag, taped to my leg with duct tape, because it's 24 hours on airplane flights to get there. And then I'm walking through the airport in Seoul, I've been sitting there sweating on the duct tape for a day, and the glue starts to fail, and I feel this baggie slipping down my leg, and this is just not good at all. And somehow I managed to not have it come completely loose, and we had to ration it, me and a couple friends of mine, because you couldn't get weed in Korea. As a different, again, alcohol, if we ran out of rationed booze, we would drink Korean booze. This we could ration. I could control and enjoy the way I use drugs. And alcohol was the closest I got to control, was that I could have a beer if I knew that later I could go out and have more. And even if I didn't go out and have more later, the knowledge that I could meant that it was okay to have just one. But if I had just one and I couldn't go out later, I was better off not having the one beer, because that phenomenon of craving would kick in. And the rest of my Army experience, went to Fort Polk, Louisiana after Korea. And if I know what Fort Polk was like, I'd have stayed in Korea. But that was the whole outfit there, all alcoholics and other kinds of lowlifes. And Fort Polk, when I was there, had the highest drug bust rate in the Army, the highest suicide rate in the Army, lowest reenlistment rate in the Army. Not long after I got out, the 5th Infantry Division was closed down because they didn't need it. We were there to, if the Mexican hordes overran Texas, we were going to backstop the Texans. Is basically what we were there for. And I was 30 days short of getting out of the Army, and they finally busted me for smoking weed on a piss test. And this was when they were really starting to crack down. And they gave me a field grade Article 15, took all my stripes, but they didn't court-martial me because two reasons. One was that I never got beyond the level of being an annoyance. I was actually not a bad soldier other than drinking too damn much. Not quite enough for them to send me to rehab, but still. Other than that, not that bad a soldier by mid-80s standards. And I was short. They had to keep me in longer to court-martial me, and they didn't want to, you know, I wasn't worth the effort is what it was. So I got out with my honorable discharge intact, which, you know, thank God these days. And then I spent about a year and a half just, I wasn't trying to get sober. It never crossed my mind to not drink, not do the other things I was doing. It just, you know, I kept on partying. And I'd saved up a little money in the Army, which lasted a few months. And in 1989, November of 89, and I was renting a room from a woman whose kids were my best friends growing up, and she's one of my best friends, and I'm still real close with them now. In fact, her second husband died a few months ago, and I'm helping her oldest son basically sort through her house with her and clean up everything and figure out what goes to trash, what goes to the farm with her, and, you know, what gets sold. That's what I'm doing every Saturday for the foreseeable future. I've known these people since 1971 when I was six. And I was renting a room from her because my dad had retired and moved to Utah. And she basically had had enough of my craziness. You know, I was way out of control, was running a couple of nonprofit operations out of her house, which I wasn't the first person to do that, but unlike the other person who was doing it, I was not discreet. And I was a raid waiting to happen, basically. And she told me I had to get out. And that was the first moment of clarity in my life, was when I looked down the list of people I could move in with. And there's, you know, this guy who just got out of jail, this guy who's probably going to go to jail, this girl I could move in but I know she's had a couple of diseases I don't want to get exposed to. And I just go down the list. You know, this guy will steal everything that I have. Never mind that, I mean, these are not lower companions because I'm right down there with them. And I got to the bottom of the list and I realized I did not have any friends at all. And I could either keep going the way I was going or try something different. And I didn't know what different I could try, but I had to try something. And so I did what every, you know, grown 24-year-old military veteran does in that situation. I picked up the phone and I called Daddy. And Daddy, being Daddy, dropped everything he was doing. Drove from Utah to Virginia, scooped me up in Virginia, drove back to Utah and dropped me off at the rehab. And I was really lucky in that the rehab, it was a state facility, but they didn't have a huge budget, so it was basically 12-step based. And their main thing was, it was a 30-day spin dry. I was there 60 days because I was really burnt and crispy and in rough shape. And they just took us to meetings. And there were only four meetings a week in this town. We got to all four of them, did a couple of house meetings. And it was mainly a place to just get sober. And I met my first sponsor when I was there at the local meetings. Several people that I'm still good friends with today. Not many. It's, you know, been a long time, and a lot of people have died. Some of them have moved. And I got my first step when I was dropped off at the rehab. The person who was doing the intake interview, Eva, she's still sober today, and she's, you know, basically read me some definitions of alcoholism out of the big book. You know, if when you honestly want to, you can't quit entirely. When you quit, you're going to restart again. And the one I related to that she read to was the alcoholic thinks that someday he'll be able to control and enjoy his drinking. And I hadn't done both of those things in a long time at the same time. And I was just like, yeah, that's me. And when you look at the first step, it's powerless over alcohol. Lives have become unmanageable. Clearly, I was powerless over alcohol. I would drink when it was a really bad idea. And then I would do really stupid things when drinking, like taking a handful of pills that I didn't know what they were. You know, start drinking and go out and party instead of doing my homework. And I was well on my way to getting expelled from a community college. And as far as my life being unmanageable, Daddy dropped me at rehab. I mean, you don't get much more manageable than that if you're, you know, a 24-year-old military veteran. It's pretty damn unmanageable. So I had a really good, solid first step. And then I go there and I look at the second step. It came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. I was a really smart guy. I mean, yeah, I'd flunked out of college. I had left the Army as an E1, but I was a smart guy, very well read. I knew I was intelligent, wasn't afraid to tell people I was intelligent. And I wouldn't call myself an atheist because I couldn't commit to not believing, but I didn't believe in a higher power. And I wasn't willing to believe in a higher power. Because when people in the meetings, and they were all these, you know, old farts that were like in their 50s or older, and they'd been sober like, you know, incomprehensible amounts of time, like 20 years. And they had something I wanted. I could see this look in their faces and their eyes that they had something I wanted. But when they said that Alcoholics Anonymous was a spiritual program and that I needed to find a higher power, I heard them saying religion and God. And this was Southern Utah, so I knew which religion and which God they were pushing. And I wanted nothing to do with that because I was smart. But I did stay sober there. I essentially used my home group as my higher power, which isn't a bad idea if you never move. And there was a university right there in town, Southern Utah University. Great school for undergraduate work. Went there for 3 years straight through on GI Bill. Graduated with a 3.0 with a computer science major and a very strong math minor. If I had taken abstract algebra, it would have been a double major. And it would have been 24 upper division hours in my last quarter. And I would not have held the 3.0. I would have passed, but I wouldn't have held the 3.0. And I wanted that 3.0. A little bit of intellectual pride there. And I graduated college. And I came back east to get a job. And my higher power, which was my home group, did not come back east with me. And I ran out of good ideas quick. Because I wasn't going to meetings. Wasn't talking to my sponsor because he was back in Utah, and this was well before cell phones. And after, you know, I got a job here, and after a couple months here, I'm not sure, it was during the summer, so it was probably in July, and I graduated in May. I went into a bar, and I knew it was a bad idea. I had a first step. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew it was a bad idea to go in there. Like the book said, I knew I was being none too bright. But I didn't have a better idea. So that's what I did. And I went downhill quick. I became unemployable very fast. Me and my buddy Tom got it started. Basically, it was a nonprofit crack dealing operation. Because I had a car and a driver's license, and he didn't have either of those things. And he had the connections. And so he would keep, you know, booze for me, gas for the car, a little crack for me to keep me, you know, conscious and not blacking out or passing out. And it's basically two white boys and a 65 Baja Bug driving through Southeast D.C. at night in the winter of 93-94 during the height of the crack wars. And never saw cops down, because cops didn't go into that part of town after dark. You got all the dirtbags are killing each other. Why would the cops want to stop that? Makes their lives easier. They come in during the day, scoop up the bodies, you know, haul them off. And I realized at some point in time during that winter that I was going to be dead soon, within weeks. And it was not going to be pretty. They were going to be picking me up in the morning with some holes in me. And I knew what I had done before to get sober. I'd gone to meetings in Utah. And then we had this ice storm. There was like a couple inches of sleet, and I couldn't go anywhere. I'd gotten sober. I started going to meetings. Got a sponsor. And when the storm hit, because I couldn't get to the meeting, I couldn't walk out of the house without falling down and, you know, injuring myself. No one was driving anywhere. And I called my sponsor, and he was drunk. And that'll mess with your serenity if you're brand new and still detoxing. So I hopped in my Volkswagen as soon as the ice melted and drove back to Utah. And I got to Kansas City, and I put cheap Ford spark plugs in that Volkswagen, and it ate a spark plug when I was going down I-70 at about 65 miles an hour. One piston stopped, the other three kept going. It's the most horrifying noise I've ever heard from a car engine. And I pulled out my small box of stuff that I still had. And I signed the title and left it there for whoever wanted it because I did not have money for a new engine. I'd been unemployable for a while, and the crack dealing operation was completely nonprofit. You know, the bus ticket was basically the last of my money, almost. And somewhere in Colorado, a guy got on the bus who was going through DTs. And I'd been taught by the old-timers back in Utah, this one guy, Wally, his first grand sponsor was Bill W. He'd been sober like forever. And he said, in a situation like that, all you can do is give him a pint in the big book and hope for the best. And that's what I did. The next stop, I went to a liquor store, and I'm still detoxing, but I buy a pint for this guy, give him a pint in my last big book, give it to him. I have no idea if he stays sober. But I did. And I got to Utah, and this time when I was sober, and I say my sobriety date is April Fool's Day because I'm not sure when this happened, because I was really crispy. I mean, not just the crack, but there was, you know, a lot of acid in there and a whole bunch of other things and all the booze, and I was just no real idea what my sobriety date is, but I know I was sober by April 1st of 1994. Because by then the fog had lifted enough that I could look back on it and go, oh yeah, that's somewhere around there. And I looked at what the people that had gotten sober with me at this time, close to almost 5 years before, I guess, had done, and they'd come to believe in a higher power. And I was like, if that worked for them, maybe it'll work for me. The thing is that, and I've been told this when I was sober the first time, and I don't hear it a lot anymore, but it's certainly my experience that you can be too smart to get sober. You cannot be too stupid to get sober. I knew a guy who was riding his motorcycle at like 80 miles an hour on I-15, came off it, went headfirst into a rock garden, could hardly speak. He got sober. He had no problem getting sober. Smart people like me end up going out and getting drunk. But crack and Cuervo cured me of being too smart. Didn't give me a higher power, but I became willing to believe. And once I had that willingness, then the rest of the steps could start working. Because you read through the literature and it says all you need to do is just be willing to believe. And all the old timers are telling me was you need a higher power. It didn't say what. They didn't care what kind of higher power I had. They just wanted me to have something that I could rely on when it was just me. And looking back, I could see times when there was a higher power working in my life. Like, I'm still detoxing and I buy a pint for this other guy and give him the pint in the big book and I stay sober. I do not buy a pint and then give it away, especially not when it's like my last dollars. I mean, I'd been on the no food money diet plan for, you know, a few days by that time. But I stayed sober through that. That's the only explanation, is that something beyond me was working in my life, that I was doing something for someone else, and that kept me sober. But once I was willing to believe in a higher power, I'd done a fairly honest and thorough four-step first time, but I was able to do a completely honest one the second time. Was able to do a fifth step. Six and seven are still kind of, you know, woo-woo for me. I know I've done a good seventh step when I'm not only have made my eighth step list, but I'm not doing the things that go on the eighth step list. I'm no longer doing those things that, now there are other things I have to make amends for, but those things are on the eighth step list. I'm not having to add to that list. That's how I know I've done six and seven. You know, first time I did fifth step with a sponsor, I'd been sober before, so this whole, you know, the white light shining on you and the window, the higher power's blowing through you, that never really happened for me. And later fifth steps, it's the same way. There's just someone who knows everything about me that I can, you know, be honest with. And that's, you know, I haven't needed that white light experience. The ninth step, the financial part was easy. My dad was an engineer type. He had an itemized list of my bills, basically, that he found out about and that I could add to. The money I owed to people in the drug trade was, my sponsor said, don't worry about that. That all comes out in the wash. You rip them off, they rip you off. It's, you know, don't worry about it. All the rest of it, like I said, my dad had the itemized list. You know, the amends to him for having flunked out of college on his nickel was to graduate with a 3-point on the GI Bill. And he never knew about the nonprofit crack dealing operation, the rest of it, and my sponsor said he didn't need to know about that. He hadn't been supporting me at the time, so it was, you know, he didn't need to know. And some of the ninth step amends were, the hardest one for me to do was with my mother, because she basically died before I was drinking alcoholically. And in a way, it was more of an Al-Anon ninth step kind of thing. And I'd done Al-Anon for a few months when I was sober the first time, and my Al-Anon sponsor said I needed to go to more AA meetings. So I did. but Al-Anon was a tremendous help when I was writing my fourth step down. But that ninth step, you know, I did the writing, the letter thing and all that, and it just, none of that seemed to work. It took time. I was probably 20 years sober when I realized that the effects I get from the ninth step with respect to my mother had happened. That was at some point in the past that had, I'd been able to put that behind me and to say that, you know, we were good in that relationship. Other ones with friends, like I said, I'm helping my friend Glory clean out her house. And that's, you know, not really ninth step, it's just, you know, something we do for friends. But, you know, I was not a very good friend of hers when I was running the various operations out of her house, so now I'm a good friend to her and her kids. And her youngest son managed to very cleverly get himself deployed to Afghanistan while we're doing all this cleanup. So he's State Department. He's sitting in the embassy in Kabul, and we're there, you know, digging through this house. And the biggest ninth step really was with my dad. You know, he hadn't really seen me at my worst, but he'd seen the effects of it. And a lot of that was, you know, there's the, you know, the face-to-face events where I sit down and I've got, you know, this is what I did. What can I do to make it right? And he's telling me, you're doing it. Keep doing it. But, the, you know, there's also the living amends, which I was doing. And just being a son to him. And a couple of years ago, you know, we were out there. I went out to Utah every Christmas to visit with him and every July 4th to visit with him for a week each time. And we were out for a walk, and he found a patch of ice, and the first thing that hit the ground was the back of his head. So off to the emergency room, and there was a brain bleed, so off to the ICU. And then I had, you know, a week there, and then I had to come home, and he went into a rehab, and it was just all sorts of medical drama. And I was fortunate that I was in a job where I could work remotely. Actually, at the time, it was more a case of not working remotely. But they were paying me, and they were aware of the situation, so it was like, not unspiritual, I guess. And I was able to get out there every month while he was in the rehab for a couple weeks and just get down with him every day, see how he couldn't talk for a while. Mentally, he was fine. He was, you know, his mental skills were there. He was able to do his taxes that year, you know, just sitting down with all the paperwork and doing his taxes. And I was able to push on the doctors to get him out of the rehab once he was well enough because he wanted out of there and make sure he was okay at home. And last year, on May 7th, on a Sunday, just finished dinner, getting ready to go to my home group, Midtown, and I got a call that he'd fallen in the driveway. He'd come home from church where he sang in the choir. Now, my dad was a stone atheist, did not believe in God at all, but he sang in the choir every Sunday because he liked the music and that was his social life, so whatever, you know. And the preacher knew it was interesting situation, but, you know, Presbyterians, so they're kind of cool with that, I guess. And, you know, I got that call, and I talked to the nurse, and the nurse said, the prognosis is not good. You should get out here soon. And I've got several friends who are nurses. I knew exactly what that meant. And so I, first thing I did was call my sponsor, because that's what I do in a crisis. That's why I talk to my sponsor, even if there's nothing major going on in my life. A couple of times a week, I'm meeting with them face-to-face, talking to them on the phone, so that when something's going on, there's no problem calling him. And that was what I did. First thing I did, call my sponsor. Then I went to my home group and talked to them face-to-face and talked to some other people. And there are several people in my home group that have experience with this kind of thing. And then I bought a plane ticket, went out there, and just took care of business. He died while I was on the way out there. And the thing that I was really grateful for was that I had finished that ninth step, because there was nothing in the way of that relationship when I got out there. It was just like all I had to do was just do the next right thing. And while there was sadness, there wasn't like the deep grief, the, you know, oh my God, if only we'd, because, you know, we'd spent, you know, I'd spent 10 years living out there after I got sober this time. And saw him all, pretty much every day, and cooked dinners for him a lot and all that. And then once I came back here in 2000, I was out there twice a year, or more if I could, you know, if I had a business trip going out that way. And so there was, you know, I'd been a son to him. And we talked after his fall about what to do if, or rather when, because we knew it was going to be when. And having the ninth step done, it was just, because I've known people that didn't have that opportunity. And, you know, thank God I had a sponsor who early on had pushed me to do that. So that when I was only, you know, a couple, 3 years sober, I'd done the ninth step, pretty much all of it with everyone. Now, there are people on the list that if I run into them randomly, then I make amends, but otherwise not having to seek anyone out or anything like that. And we, you know, we buried him, and, well, he was cremated, and he's buried at Alexandria Cemetery, which is right down the road from Arlington and has a lot more room. And he wanted the cheapest possible funeral. So that's what we did. He was a veteran. And that was part of the ninth step, too, carrying out his wishes. You know, whatever other members of the family may have wanted, he wanted this, and that's, and the rest of the family was cool with it. And it was, while dealing with, I mean, he had a 5,000-square-foot house. I wasn't keeping everything. So I had my cousins come out from that side of the family, and they all were helping me sort through stuff, and they were talking about the family history. The great-grandfather who got sober and after 2 weeks decided he'd rather drink and was dead by the time he was 50. The various other people in the family on that side who, alcoholism, eating disorders, or manic depression, just everywhere, except my dad. He was the one guy that didn't have that. All my cousins all have issues of some kind or another. And they're all, I've got one that's sober, not through AA, but she's sober. And a couple others that had the other issues that they're coping with. And that was when I learned a lot of the family. It's like, oh, wow, my dad was, he was the only normal one in the family. And I was not at all unusual by my family standards. And, you know, over the years, the 10th, 11th, and 12th step, the 10th step, I had an ability, this gift, that I could say exactly the wrong thing to exactly the wrong person at exactly the wrong time. I would think it was funny, and they wouldn't. And, I mean, I still will think it's funny, and they don't, but it took me about 10 years into sobriety to realize when I heard it from someone else that if I think it's funny, I shouldn't say it. And that has helped a lot with not having to make, you know, amends to people later. I can still get that look sometimes. Did you really say, oh, you've really said that? That look. I think some of us are familiar with that. I'm certainly very familiar with it. And 12 step, I help people. You know, I'm not sponsoring anyone now. I tend to start sponsoring someone, and then he's like, he's going to pick up his friend, a crack dealer who's getting, you know, evicted, or, you know, something like that. So I'm like, you know, well, let me know how that works out. Or you know, I say, well, just go to the meetings I go to, and I go to a meeting almost every day, and they don't want to do that, and so no, not sponsoring anyone right now. But I have service at most of the meetings I go to, either, you know, formal positions or I just help set up and help clean up. I make cookies at my home group, even though, you know, I don't have a formal position there. A few months ago, I got a job that was going to require 50% travel, so I couldn't commit to any service positions because I was going to be traveling too much. So I just did what I could when I get to the meetings. And when I was in Seattle, I did what I could at the meetings there that I was getting to. And thinking of the higher power working in my life, the earliest evidence of that is giving the guy the pint. Another one was the way I found my home group. I'd come out in 2000 for a job interview, and I happened to go to the Starbucks in McLean, because I'd grown up in McLean, so I went to the Starbucks there to get a cup of coffee. And at that time, that was where the people from the from my home group who went to a meeting called Up the Tubes on Wednesday night went to. And I was wearing my DC Icky Paw shirt, because when I was younger, I was really into the YPAW stuff. These days, I'm into going to bed early and not hanging out at the drum circle, so I don't see the YPAWs anymore. But back then, I was still into it, and I'd been to the DC Icky Paw in 98. And my home group, my current home group, had been the home group for that Icky that had put on that Icky Paw. So there's like 60 people there. Half of them were at that Icky Paw, and they see this guy there with an Icky Paw t-shirt that they don't know. So this guy that we call Rabbi Mike, who's not Jewish, but they called him Rabbi Mike for some reason, sat down next to me, we started talking. He said, we got this meeting tonight right down the road. You want to go? I was like, sure. And because that's what I do when I'm on the road, is I, you know, if I can find a good meeting, I go to it. And so I went to that one, and they said, you know, there's this meeting tomorrow called Choir. Do you want to come? Sure, why not? You know, I was there through Sunday, leaving Sunday, and went to the, got the job offer on Thursday, and, you know, went to the Friday meeting, the 12 and 12 there in McLean. And that was how I found my home group, just randomly. Sat down at the Starbucks where that group happened to hang out at the time. And another place where I saw, and this time I saw it almost immediately, the higher power working in my life, was I'm a computer programmer, and I've been doing government work for the past 17 years. And I was on a government contract with an agency that basically they have armed guards at the gates, and you have to have the proper badges to get to the various places in it. And I did not have the proper badges, so I had to be escorted everywhere. And we were, you know, we were releasing some software, so we were doing a, you know, party at the customers, and I'm figuring, this is a government facility, nothing to worry about here, no big deal. And I walk into this third level sub basement, and someone pulls a beer up and shoves my face, want a beer? And I can't leave, because if I go to the wrong place, you know, I'll get arrested at least. And my escort doesn't want to leave yet because he's there for the party. And I can't call my sponsors. You can't know about all the, you can't call from there. Well, you can, but they're all monitored. And, you know, so can't call the sponsor. Don't have my big book with me. And I intuitively knew to go stand by the sodas because there's a cooler full of sodas. And to get a soda in my hand, because if you have a drink in your hand, no one offers you a drink. Well, not these days, not the parties I go to anyway, and not at this party. And it was a couple hours before my escort could leave and or was willing to leave and escort me out. And I didn't visibly freak out or anything. No one seemed to notice anything going on. And I just, you know, drank a lot of sodas for a couple hours. And, I mean, everybody else, it wasn't like a beer bust. It was like everybody, because they're all normal drinkers. If you're an active alcoholic, you're going to have a little trouble getting a security clearance. Well, you can, but it's you're going to have trouble holding it. And so they all would have, like, one beer over the course of 2 hours. Drove me nuts. And then I was able to leave, and it was like, I didn't have a beer. I stayed sober. Where they were willing to give me the beer, and no one knew that I was an alcoholic, and yet I stayed sober. Wow. That must be a higher power. I was, like, 10 years sober at the time, something like that. You know, it's real, like I said, I'm a real smart guy, highly intelligent, real quick learner. I was like the first time I saw a higher power working in my life. And I don't know what my higher power is. It's not me. That's the important thing my sponsors told me that I told their newcomers, that there is a higher power. It's not me. It's not you. It's something out there. It's something I can rely on when it's just me, and I may not even have a big book. And I was probably, it was around that time, 12, 13 years ago, that I was talking to a friend of mine saying, you know, I didn't pray. You know, I tried it. You know, my sponsor said, you know, pray on your knees every morning, every evening. You know, in the morning you ask God to keep you sober, in the evening you thank Him for keeping you sober, and, you know, ask for help with whatever, and, you know, if it'll help others. And I did that, and my knees got sore, and I didn't feel like I was getting anything at all out of it. And so I figured that just meant that, you know, prayer didn't work for me. And so I wasn't praying. And I'm talking to this friend. I'm like telling him how I'm in the car and I'm driving along. And I'm like, man, please help me not be an ass today. And I'm telling him I don't pray. He's like, well, when you're asking to help me not be an ass, who are you with? Well, just me. Well, then who are you asking? Yourself? Well, no. You must be asking a higher power. Well, yeah, I guess. That's prayer. If I'm driving along the road and asking, please help me not be an ass on the road today, and I'm the only one in the car, I'm praying. That's pretty much my go-to prayer in the morning is, please help me be useful and help me not be an ass. And I don't know what I'm praying to. Like I said, it's not me. Something out there that works in my life. And that prayer always gets answered. You know, if I ask for help to not be an ass, I get that help. Other prayers, usually the answer is no. You know, if it's a prayer for something for me, If it's something I think that someone else needs and I pray for it, often the answer is going to be mind your own business. Occasionally it's okay, you ask for it, you're going to get it, is the answer, and I get what I prayed for good and hard. So usually, like I said, my go-to prayer, help me not be an ass, and leave it at that, because that's generally not going to get help that's objectionable to me if I'm asking for that. And things have worked out in my life. I realized the promises were coming true, and I had a period of unemployment, and I was like about a week away. I was basically out of money, had maxed the credit cards. I was a week away from being homeless. I was going to be couch surfing is what it was. I talked to some friends, and I realized I was going to be okay. That, I mean, yes, it was going to suck, but I was going to be okay. And, I mean, I got a job, and I got a paycheck like the day before the rent was due, and things worked out that way. But if they hadn't, I'd have been okay with it. Wouldn't have liked it, but I'd have been okay with it. There's a lot of stuff in my life that I have to be okay with it, even if I don't like it. And it's, I can accept something that I don't approve of, which took me a long time to learn that one, too. And I think we're going to end early. thank you all for listening.
Yeah, thank you.